From Arkansas to Idaho, Massachusetts to Nevada, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, as voters go to the polls, questions about the integrity of the electoral process continue to swirl. Ken Cuccinelli from the Election Transparency Initiative is here to discuss efforts to ensure the election is conducted fairly. The 2024 general election is upon us. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth is here with a real story on key races for control of the U.S. House and Senate. If the polls are correct, a number of voting groups are realigning their party support. Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine report. And under the guise of climate change, the left is waging a war on reliable and affordable energy. It is a war they must lose. Jonathan Williams from the American Legislative Exchange Council has this week's American Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Following the 2020 presidential election, many voters questioned the integrity of the election process. This time around, there have been efforts to ensure the balloting is conducted fairly. Ken Cuccinelli is national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. He joins us now to discuss their efforts. Ken, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Ken, there has been a lot of litigation in various states around the country. If you could point to the top cases that you think are going to have a big impact in terms of voters having confidence in the integrity of this election we have coming up in just a couple of days.
Well, one of them was in Pennsylvania. It was the Third Circuit, which is the Federal Court of Appeals in Pennsylvania. It was the Third Circuit decision that really eliminated the whole Democrat effort to try to nitpick ballots at mail-in ballots using the Voting Rights Act. They wanted to say everything was material. That was the word, material. And that voter registration was something that they could challenge your state on and how they were doing it. And the Third Circuit, which is not a Republican circuit, rejected that. And that all sounds very messy, and it is very messy, but the bottom line is it got rid of an entire line of a litigation attack that the left has been using to try to muddy up the ballot situation. And the reason that's important is they have a huge litigation advantage. And whenever you have a muddy situation, it gets resolved in courts. And they're trying to create the opportunities for lots more litigation. And the court rejected that in Pennsylvania at the appellate court level. And the Third Circuit is viewed as pretty authoritative on that. So I think that'll hold all around the country. And so far it has. So that's a big deal. But a bigger deal in the change since 2020, and this is the only nice thing I've ever had to say about the Republican National Committee. Literally, this is it. Since 2020, they have gotten in the game as it relates to offensive litigation. That means litigation that sues states like Secretary of State Benson in Michigan when they're not following their own laws. The Georgia Supreme Court recently ruled on a case out of the midterm election, the 2022 election. And what they said was, I thought, very valuable. They said, look, you're here in court complaining about the rules and you filed this after the election. Don't come whining to us after the election is over about something that you could have challenged before. Well, now, and for 4 years, the RNC, along with a lot of right-of-center groups, are challenging these states who are disobeying their own laws. One of the biggest problems in 2020 was states not obeying their own laws. And they're actually on offense. The Democrats have been doing this for 20 years, since 2004. And the Republicans just got into the game. And it's part of the reason we're so much better off as we head into Tuesday's election than we were 4 years ago in 2020. I'd give America a D grade on the 2020 election. I think we're up to about a C+, B minus, depending on where you are. And Pennsylvania is right on the line there of C+, B minus. So we obviously have a lot of work to do, but But it's also obvious that we're doing much better than we were 4 years ago. And this litigation is a big part of it.
What is the SAVE Act, and how will that impact the integrity of the upcoming election?
So it will not affect the upcoming election. The SAVE Act, I think everybody knows, probably listening to you and me, that it is illegal for non-citizens to vote in our federal elections. What people may not realize is that there's virtually no way to enforce that, not effectively. The only state that has any system at all is Arizona. And the reason for this problem is because of some federal court rulings, including one issued by Justice Scalia as the main author. So you can't just say liberal judges. He literally read what was in statutes, and it restricts states' ability to check citizenship. So the SAVE Act was passed by the House under Chip Roy and his sponsorship and Speaker Johnson's leadership, who, to his credit, pushed it forward. It gives states all of the tools they need. A better way to think of it is it gets all the impediments out of the way for confirming citizenship for voters. And I'm sure most people listening are like, you got to be kidding me. This is controversial. Only 5 Democrats voted for it. All the rest voted against it. Well, why on earth would they vote against that? I think that's a very fair question that people may put to most of those Democrats. And Chuck Schumer hasn't brought it up in the Senate, thus it won't affect this election. And Joe Biden said he would veto it anyway. And you have to ask yourself, why would you veto actually making it enforceable to only have citizens voting in our elections? And I think that's a very legitimate question that probably only has one answer. And that is that they're not all that upset about the possibility of non-citizens voting in our elections.
That, however, causes a lot of people to shake their heads, as you've alluded to here, Ken.
Yeah.
We had another situation that developed here with Hurricane Helene, and it had a great impact. And as always, our thoughts and prayers go out to the people of North Carolina, Georgia, Amen. Florida. The recovery is underway. How do you see that impacting the election? Will those states be able to ensure that all the people in the hurricane-stricken areas will be able to cast their ballots?
My observation is that the answer to that is yes, everywhere except North Carolina. Governor Roy Cooper did such a bad job out of the box. And it's so bad. I know Roy Cooper. We served as attorneys general together. I was Virginia's while he was North Carolina's. I don't think he's that incompetent. I think this was intentional foot dragging, knowing very well that a slow recovery means you don't get to the voting piece quickly, because Maslow's hierarchy of needs, right? First, if you worry about where your family is going to get their next meal and tomorrow's meal and where are you going to sleep tonight, if you're worrying about those things, you're not really thinking about who you're voting for president. That's not a concern to you. And I think Roy Cooper took advantage of that. I think it's sad and pathetic and partisan and terrible, but it's the only explanation I've got. He's just not that incompetent. But there are going to be less votes in that swath of North Carolina. That is a Trump-heavy portion of North Carolina, save only for Asheville, but overall it's a Trump-heavy area. And in a state the president won by about 1.5% in 2020, he looks good now in polling, but I don't really trust polling. He's going to lose probably on net 5 or 10 or 20,000 votes out of that region, just people who just can't pull it off. He's going to have to make that up elsewhere in the state.
Well, everything, of course, appears to be on a razor's edge. We shall see here in really a matter of days, hours at this particular point. We have been talking with Ken Cuccinelli. He is national chairman of the Election Transparency Initiative. Ken Cuccinelli, as always, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. We're down to the final days, the final hours before campaign 2024 comes to an end, and we actually have the voters make decisions. We're going to take an overview of all of the national races now with Scott Parkinson. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman.
Congress, the U.S. House of Representatives, Scott, Republicans have had the narrowest of majorities for the last 2 years. Want to give us a look at the landscape for this year?
Republicans currently hold a 220 to 212 Republican majority. 3 seats are currently vacant from a couple of deaths. And then one early resignation with Mike Gallagher and the 8th District of Wisconsin. Listen, Democrats just need to gain 6 seats to reclaim the House majority. you know, you think about the different races that are in play for Republicans to pick up. You think about all the redistricting that's happened from states like Alabama and Louisiana that have gained Democrat seats, and then also states like North Carolina that have picked up a few Republican seats. And then you think about what they did in New York with all those really competitive races that Lee Zeldin helped get across the finish line in 2022. We've obviously had Trump campaigning in New York trying to help out those House Republicans. But this is a coin flip. And when you're thinking about your member of Congress, typically people have a pretty good approval of their individual member. But nationally, the House of Representatives' opinion and approval rating is really in the dumps. I think there's going to be overall an anti-incumbency wave where there's a few shockers and people are sent home packing by their constituents. The House has sort of been a mess. We've gone through different speakers from Kevin McCarthy now to Mike Johnson. They've failed to, I think, responsibly tackle the debt and deficit issues. We had a big negotiation underneath Kevin McCarthy that led to the debt limit being suspended through 2025. We've had inflation reach 40-year highs. We've had really the Biden administration be able to not be held accountable through subpoenas and through oversight in the House. And so I think it's important for these House Republicans and their closing message to really articulate what they're going to be doing in 2025 to advance the Trump agenda. And there's only going to be, you know, less than 2 years, because after 2026, you're going to be in a situation here where Trump will be a lame duck president. And even if you've got the House still being held to a narrow majority, I think a lot of things are going to get blocked by the Senate and sort of the swampiness of Washington, D.C. It's an exciting time. These House races are really important. We've got some really great conservatives that are running. Nick Begich in Alaska is going to take down Mary Peltola. You've got other big important races for reelection like Scott Perry in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We need to make sure he's sent back to Washington, D.C. to defend freedom. And he's obviously a former chairman of the Freedom Caucus. Then you've got other competitive races in states like California and New York that I mentioned. I think the House is going to be super exciting. We'll be watching closely over here at the club.
And over in the upper chamber, the U.S. Senate, Republicans, the map favoring Republicans this time around. A lot of optimism floating around, Scott, that Republicans could reclaim the majority in the Senate.
Well, I'm one of those optimistic folks in D.C. that thinks that we really can win the Senate majority. We've got great pickup opportunities, obviously, with West Virginia already being a lock with Jim Justice. Then over in Montana, Tim Sheehy is in great shape right now against John Tester. In Ohio, Bernie Moreno has a real shot to defeat Sherrod Brown. In Nevada, Sam Brown can beat Jackie Rosen. And in Arizona, Kari Lake facing Ruben Gallego is going to be a toss-up. Then in Michigan, Mike Rogers against Alyssa Slotkin. In Wisconsin, Eric Hovde has a ton of momentum. He just campaigned with Trump and Brett Favre over there in Green Bay, running against Tammy Baldwin. And then in Maryland, Larry Hogan is running against Angela Alsobrooks. That one's going to be a really tough one for Hogan to win, but it's one to keep your eyes on. And then in your state, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, Dave McCormick is facing longtime career politician Bob Casey. And despite Casey trying to run pro-Trump ads, we know that he's been a Biden lackey and that he's going to lose that race to McCormick. A couple of important incumbent races. We got to watch Ted Cruz and Rick Scott over there in Texas and Florida. I think ultimately Deb Fischer is going to be fine against Dan Osborne in Nebraska. But we are going to win the United States Senate majority and make sure that we can get some big tax cuts passed through reconciliation in 2025.
And then we have the biggest race of all, the White House, who will be the next president of the United States. Scott, both Donald Trump and Kamala Harris each held their big closing rallies, and both of those rallies got hijacked by somebody else. So where does that leave us as we're just hours away from balloting?
Yeah, I mean, I think you look all the way back to when Donald Trump was defeated in 2020 and how far he's come as an individual and as a candidate and sort of the circle of life in politics. Trump is stronger than ever right now. I think that he's really connected with the American people on a level that many people didn't expect him to be able to do, whether it's with our nation's veterans or armed forces that are currently active, or whether it's with the McDonald's worker and the garbage truck driver, Trump is really in a position right now, when you look at all these competitive races, all these competitive states, the coattails that he brings, to really deliver power for the American people, not power for his individual appetite. And that's what this has always been about, right? Trump fights for the American people, and the political oligarchy in Washington, D.C., that has been controlled by these career politicians like Joe Biden and Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell, and really these people that have only looked out for themselves, those days are in the rearview mirror. I think we're moving forward. We're going to make America great again, and Trump is going to win a big reelection in 2024.
Well, Scott, the next time we talk next week, maybe we'll know the results of all of these races, or at least some of them. So we'll go over what we know next week and then continue to follow up as some of these states are going to take days, if not weeks, to get everything clarified. So we will check in with you at that point. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
Well, Club for Growth is based out of Washington, D.C. We also operate Club for Growth PAC and Club for Growth Action. If you want to take a moment and just visit clubforgrowth.org, you can find out about all the races that we're involved in right now, and you can sign up and become a member for free.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
You are welcome.
The 2024 presidential election may see a realignment of several voting groups. For details, we turn to Eric Boehm and Stephanie Slade of Reason Magazine.
The polls suggest that this year's presidential race is basically neck and neck as we head down the stretch here. But that's not the only thing that the polls say. There's some more interesting data in there that goes beyond who's just winning and who's losing. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Reason's own Stephanie Slade. She's a senior editor at Reason, and she's sort of our in-house expert when it comes to polling, kind of constantly reminding us not to take any poll too seriously. But we're going to talk a little bit about what's in the polls with her today. Slade, thanks for taking some time with us here.
Happy to be with you.
Let's, obviously, I think everybody probably wants me to ask you who's going to win, but we'll get that information soon enough. Regardless of who wins next week, there's been kind of some interesting information that we've gleaned from polling this year. And the thing I wanted to ask you about specifically is the shift that we've seen with African-American and Hispanic voters, and I guess specifically really men within those two categories. What has the polling showed us there during this whole cycle?
Yeah, it's not even just the polling from this cycle. It's actually going back at least as far as 2012. We've seen a shift from where Hispanic and African-American voters overwhelmingly favoring the Democratic Party to that margin eroding over time. So from 2012 to 2020, we saw a 19-point shift by Hispanics in the direction of the Republican Party from the Democratic Party, and among Black voters, an 11-point shift. Now, these two demographic groups, they're still voting more for Democrats than for Republicans, but the size, the overwhelming identification that they once had with the Democratic Party seems to be eroding. It seems like they are more and more up for grabs.
Yeah, the shift from, say, 90% to 70%, pretty significant, even if the majority are still going for Democrats. That has gotten some attention. And then there's also been quite a bit written this cycle about this new dynamic that's emerged where education seems to be, or education level seems to be, kind of a differentiating factor between who's voting for which party.
Yeah. So when it comes to race, I think it's better to think in terms of a de-alignment than a realignment. In other words, it used to be that, you know, Hispanic and African-American voters were very much aligned with the Democratic Party. They identify with that party as being part of their personal identity. And it's seeming to be quite as true as it once was. So that's a de-alignment. That doesn't mean that they're all rushing over to be, you know, Republican voters probably in the time. Education, on the other hand, there does seem to be what you might call a realignment. That is to say, once upon a time, we thought about the Republican Party as being mostly voters who were, you know, more affluent, more highly educated, the business owners, the country clubbers, that sort of thing. Meanwhile, we thought of the Democratic Party as being the home of blue-collar voters, you know, working class, people who don't have a college degree. And that seems to have completely flipped in the last few years. So that if you are a white working class American voter without a college degree, you are much more likely to support Donald Trump than in 2020 than Joe Biden and say than Kamala Harris. So this is actually, and the opposite is true as well, if you have a college degree, you are much more likely than you once were to be a Democratic voter. So this really is a realignment. We've seen the thing that educational attainment points to actually, you know, once upon a time it pointed one direction, and now it points the exact opposite direction.
How much of this do you think is due to Trump? I mean, I know maybe this is a question that goes somewhat beyond just the data that's in the poll, but how much of this do you attribute specifically to Trump, and how much do you attribute to broader political factors that maybe go beyond him or maybe help even explain him?
Yeah, I think it's actually a lot less about Donald Trump and a lot more about where the Democratic Party, especially the sort of left wing of the Democratic Party, has gone in recent years. I think the evidence and the data is pretty clear that Black and Hispanic voters and working class voters are far more socially conservative than white, highly educated Democratic voters. And what that means is they don't like the woke extremism, right? The sort of craziness on trans issues and the flirting with socialism, this is not winning over these racial minorities and working class voters. In fact, if anything, I think the Democratic Party flirting with more extreme cultural positions is driving these groups out of the Democratic coalition and sort of towards the Republican coalition, as opposed to anything that Donald Trump is doing. If anything, I mean, he's just opening the Republican Party's arms to them, but he's not attracting them with any particular thing that he stands for.
Yeah, they're not necessarily big Trump fans, but they're just trying to get away from something they disagree with. We're talking with Stephanie Slade. She's a senior editor at Reason and our in-house expert on polling and on all things having to do with what the polls are saying here as we head into the election. Slade, last thing before I let you go here, you've used these two terms, de-alignment and realignment. There's kind of a subtle difference between those two things. Explain, if you can, just what those two terms mean and kind of what they mean for the two major parties as we go forward after this election. I mean, regardless of who wins, there's going to be some reconsiderations, I think, on both sides of where the political dynamics in America lie.
Yeah, definitely true. I think, you know, realignment implies that a group of people who were once sort of safe voters for one party, that you could count on them being reliably showing up to vote, let's say, for the Democratic Party, have now switched and now they're reliably going to be voting Republican. And I think that, again, that has sort of happened or does seem to be in the process of happening when it comes to voters without a college degree. That they once were tended to be more Democratic and now they tend to be more Republican. That's more of a realignment. They've left one camp and entered another camp. Realignment, I think, is a more helpful way of thinking about what happens when voters go from being really identifying strongly with one party to being up for grabs, for being willing to entertain voting for either side. So especially young Black men seem to be people who have really de-aligned from the Democratic Party. They're in the process, it looks like, from de-aligning. They're no longer at such incredibly high margins committed to voting Democrat no matter who the Democratic nominee is. They're very willing and open to the possibility of crossing over. They're up for grabs. They're willing to vote Republican.
Yeah, just a general breakdown of those kind of identitarian silos that we've had in politics for the last couple of decades. Honestly, I think that's a good thing. I think it means more competition, really, within the electorate and within the next election cycles. Stephanie Slade from Reason, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Of course, you can find all of Slade's work at Reason.com. While you're there, you can check out my work, check out everything else we're working on as we head down the final stretch run here to the election. I'm Eric Boehm, and you can catch me again next week after the election when we'll try to sort through what we know here on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Reliable and affordable energy is the key to a healthy economy. But the left is waging war on the most dependable and economical sources. We learn more from Jonathan Williams of the American Legislative Exchange Council on this American Radio Journal commentary.
Energy prices continue to soar, putting a strain on American families and businesses alike. With electricity bills on the rise, the impacts are felt in every part of our daily lives. But here's the hard truth. This isn't accidental. This is a predictable outcome of a broader energy agenda that's pushed us away from affordable and reliable energy sources, making America increasingly dependent on foreign resources with little regard for financial consequences. So-called progressives continue to wage war against American energy in their attempt to command and control our economy and our way of life. The war on energy has led to a myriad of problems, from driving the crushing inflation burden on hardworking Americans in recent years to threatening the security of America and our allies abroad. It is essential for America to change course and lead the way by providing energy and infrastructure security in this time of global turbulence. The answer to these rising costs and security concerns arising from the progressives' war on energy lies not in more foreign imports or subsidies or other quick-fix policies, but in a balanced, locally controlled approach to energy that prioritizes our own American energy supply. Let's begin with security. When you look at America's energy supply chain, it is deeply concerning to realize how much we depend on foreign sources, not just for oil or natural gas, but for critical minerals and even manufactured goods such as transformers used in our energy infrastructure. Think of the minerals essential for power grids or components for renewable systems and traditional power plants alike. Many of these resources come from countries that don't always have America's best interest in mind. And even more concerning is the forced labor and child labor that is used by authoritarian foreign nations to mine rare earth minerals in many cases. A policy that ensures American security means supporting domestic production, not only of the fuel itself, but of the essential parts and materials that make up our energy infrastructure. Imagine the risks involved if a critical foreign supplier of these minerals cuts us off. By prioritizing America-made fuel and materials, we can better equip ourselves to meet demands in time of global turmoil or conflict. Then there's affordability. Americans are feeling the pinch of high energy costs in a big way, and the numbers paint a troubling picture. In recent years, residential electricity rates jumped at double-digit rates, well above the historical 6.5% average that is forecast to continue in the future with these higher costs. It's possible to achieve energy affordability by addressing the war on energy and focusing on increasing supply with energy sources that are not only low cost, but dependable year-round. Which brings us to reliability. Energy isn't reliable if it's only available when the sun shines or the wind blows. In recent years, we've seen states experience blackouts and grid failures precisely because they lack dependable, round-the-clock power sources. True energy reliability means having access to energy 24/7 without the looming threat of shortages during high-demand periods. What about clean energy? Well, the debate around green energy has been dominated by ideology rather than practical solutions, often leaving out realistic, practical ideas from the states. Resources that meet practical emission standards, like high-quality natural gas and nuclear energy, are sound ideas that shouldn't be discriminated against. Thankfully, states can set clear, realistic standards for what qualifies as clean energy, making sure taxpayer dollars fund resources that balance both environmental and economic priorities. A new ALEC model policy, the Affordable, Reliable, and Clean Energy Security Act, does just that. This innovative model is based off of 2023 Ohio law that was then adopted in Tennessee and just recently was endorsed by Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry in an executive order, provides a blueprint for state-led energy security. This model addresses energy affordability, reliability, and environmental responsibility in a single framework. It prioritizes domestic production, supports stable and cost-effective energy sources, and emphasizes reliability standards that meet demand around the clock. By adopting measures like the ALEC model, states can ensure that their energy policies safeguard local economies, minimize foreign dependencies, and offer families and businesses consistent, affordable power. States need to lead the way on putting energy back where it belongs, in the hands of the American people. A balanced all-of-the-above strategy rooted in affordability and reliability isn't just possible, it's absolutely necessary. For those of us who believe America's best days lie ahead of us, it is essential America leads the way by reducing roadblocks to real energy independence and abundance for all. For more information, you can go to ALEC.org. For American Radio Journal, I'm Jonathan Williams. Thanks for listening.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WHLO-AM and WKDD-FM in North Canton, Ohio, along with WKGM-AM in Smithfield, Virginia. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.